Happy New Year to you, since this is being broadcast for the first time on New Year's Day 2025. Hope you have a great year in the Lord. I want us to return to our study in Exodus chapter number 20. We're ready for verse number 18, which is the response that the people had to the giving of the Ten Commandments. And I have tried to portray the Ten Commandments in the scary way, the awesome way that they would have been delivered on that very first Pentecost of the Jewish nation. They are 50 days departed from Egypt. They've been on the road for 7 weeks, living with one another, several hundreds of thousands of adults. And you know that adults can get on one another's nerves. And then we got a lot of kids as well, and they can also find buttons to push, can't they? And so God has made this appointment where they're all going to come and stand in the flat area before Mount Sinai. God puts on this marvelous supernatural display of lightning and thunder and a trumpet sound and fire and smoke. And he comes down onto the Mount Sinai with all of that. And then he verbalizes the 10 words, the 10 sayings. And this is the first time that the Israeli people have actually heard God's voice. And he gives them 10 orders. The first three are very clearly about the Israelis' responsibility toward him. No other gods. Don't make idols. That would include making idols of God. And you will not use my name in vain. Basically, as I said, if you're not talking to him or about him, don't say his name. And then we have a bridge one, which is the Sabbath day. It was intended to connect the people with God on a week-by-week basis. It becomes kind of a worship day. But it was also intended to protect the people from being worked to death by other people. It's a protected community day of rest, a down day. And it's a Sabbath day, a Saturday. It's a Friday night through the daylight hours of Saturday. And so that's the bridge one. And then the remaining ones are all about getting along with other people. So you show respect to your parents because they're supposed to be looking out for you on behalf of God. You don't murder people. You don't take people's lives without very specific, legitimate reasons. You don't cheat on your spouse. You don't take other people's private belongings. You don't lie about other people. And you don't let your greed, your enviousness of other people's stuff get the best of you. Because that attitude of greed and envy will very often trigger other inappropriate things. And so those were the first 10 sayings. They would have been expressed in a couple of minutes easily. And as I mentioned, by bringing in Paul's letter to Timothy, they were intended to tell the people, knock it off. Behave yourself. Enough with the garbage treatment of other people and disrespect toward me as God. Because the law is not for people behaving themselves, it's for people misbehaving. And so knowing that the people hearing these words of God are most of them, if not all of them, guilty of things on this list, they are very afraid. Verse 18 of Exodus 20. Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off. So they were like shaken in their boots, shaken in their sandals, I suppose. Moses, when he describes how he felt on this day, he says that his knees were basically knocking. I think it literally says his hips became loose. But anyway, they stood far off means that apparently they all backed up. And that does not surprise me a bit. If you are hearing God's voice basically telling you to knock it off with some of the things that you are engaging in, your natural response is going to be to shrink back, to try to back up and get away. You remember what it's like being a kid when you were getting in trouble. You were trying to evade your mother or father or whatever authority figure it was. You were trying to get backward away from them because you knew you were in trouble. And so that's exactly where these people are. And then they do something. Now Moses, remember, is with them. He had gone up and come back to be with them while the address was going on. So they immediately said to Moses, You speak to us. We'll listen, but don't let God speak to us, lest we die. So they want Moses to be their intercessor. They are begging him to stop God from talking to them anymore because they are afraid of his words, of his judgment. And so Moses said to the people, "Don't fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." So basically, it's a scared straight program. God intended for you to have this reaction to get your attention so that you will behave yourself, that you will repent of the things that you have been engaging in. And so the people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. So Moses goes back to God, back into this miraculous presence of God there on Mount Sinai. And God is now going to continue with him regarding the rules of the community that the Israelis are supposed to follow. Remember again, the purpose of law is typically to make people who are misbehaving to knock it off, to delineate what is inappropriate, and by that to also encourage proper decorum, proper behavior. Now, Moses will no doubt be interacting with God during this next part of Pentecost. Remember, the first thing that happened was in the morning. We'll just for the fun of it say right around 9 o'clock. And you know that the saying of the Ten Commandments only takes a few moments. So there's still plenty of this day left for Moses to get the rest of this stuff. And he'll be writing it down, by the way, at God's instruction. But we will see some things that it seems to me that Moses basically has said to God, well, what about this situation? What are we supposed to do with that? And so that becomes kind of like case law, where directions are given based on circumstances that have come up. And Moses has spent 7 weeks traveling with these people. And as we know from his father-in-law's arrival, he's been in the habit of hearing from the people various cases of interacting between the Israelis that he has to solve, that he has to check in with God about and give, well, this is what you have to do. So what we're seeing in this next section is it's a compilation of those sorts of things, of what ifs and what abouts and what about this circumstance. So here we go. Exodus chapter 20, verse 22. He who is said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the people of Israel, you have seen for yourselves that I have talked with you from heaven." So that's going to be the first order of business. Moses, remind them of their Ten Commandment experience, where I actually verbalized to them what I wanted them to know about. And then he reemphasizes the no other gods part. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. So you shouldn't be worshiping other gods and goddesses, and you shouldn't be making imagery of gods and goddesses. And by the way, that would include of he who is himself. That's going to cause trouble later. Verse 24, an altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. So in worship terms, worship typically involved sacrifice, because an innocent substitute dies in the place of a guilty person. And so you have to have a place where you burn up the representative parts of the sacrificed animals, and that's called an altar. And so he says, you're going to make altars in designated places. And then in verse 25, he specifies how that altar should look. Now, the tabernacle is going to come into existence later in our story. But the people need now to know how to properly build altars and sacrifice. They've probably been up to it for a while. Now they're having it systematized. Verse 25, if you build me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. So this is the first rule of making an altar in the country, not talking about the tabernacle, but a country altar. You make it from natural stones. You don't take a chisel and a hammer to it, because if you do, you've damaged the naturalness of it. We've talked about how Moses was told to take his sandals off when he first met with God here on Mount Sinai, because it was holy ground. And I expressed to you that the reason behind that is he should have no man-made substance between his feet, which was his feet are God-made, and the earth, which is God-made. So nothing between the things that God made. The reason that men were supposed to pray without a covering on their head was so that there would be nothing man-made between the top of their head, made by God, and God himself. Same principle applies here. If you're going to sacrifice to God, it ought to be on things that are natural, made by God, not things that have been altered by humans. Verse 26, you shall not go up by steps or a ladder to my altar, that your nakedness be not exposed on it. Now, nakedness does not mean the total absence of clothing. It's got more to do with appropriateness. So the priests, and we're going to start talking about priests more later, when they had an altar, typically it'd be a pretty good-sized altar, and they needed to get the meat, the sacrificial components up onto the burning area. And so to do that, one of the quick ways would be to make a ladder or to make some steps that are like a ladder, and then you just walk up them. But when you do that, well, anyone that's down below the ladder can actually kind of look up your skirt, because remember, they wore robes. And so that would be culturally inappropriate. I sometimes bring things up from my past to try to help you get a sense of this. It used to be, way back when I was a kid, that it was inappropriate for a woman's slip to be seen. You know, if your skirt blew up a little bit and your slip showed, that was inappropriate. Or if your slip was slipping a little farther down below your hemline of your dress, that was inappropriate. And so that's what's being expressed here, is inappropriateness. No one should be able to see up into the calves and knee area of these men that are putting the sacrifices up onto the altar. And so for that reason, they were supposed to use ramps. Chapter 21. Now, these are the rules that you shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, now we need to define some things here very clearly. A Hebrew slave that is being talked about here is a person who has gone into debt, and they have therefore been turned into a temporary slave. They have an indebtedness contract that they are working off. Now, those contracts can be transferred from person to person. So let's say that I was working for John Doe because I owed John Doe $40,000. And then Billy Green said, "Hey, John Doe, I need somebody with his abilities to work for me. Let me pay you what he owes, and then he'll come and work for me." And so then my indebtedness contract would be transferred over. So that's what's being described here in verse number 2. When you buy the indebtedness contract of a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go free for nothing. Now again, we have to specify and make some clarification here. It's not any old 6 years. It's a sabbatical cycle that we're talking about. And this cycle will get started when they enter the promised land, because they will work for 6 years in a row, and then the seventh year will be a sabbatical year, a year of rest for the land and for the people and for the animals. And basically, no matter where in that cycle a person goes into indebtedness as a slave, when the sixth year of that cycle comes to a close, whatever they owe still is written off. It's done. It's gone. And so this is going to be very helpful to the Israeli people to stay out of debt, because it'll always be refreshed at the end of 6 years. Now, some of you might go, "Wow, so you could just like run up a whole bunch of accounts and things in year six and get away with it." No, people know when the contract period is going to be over with, so they're not going to extend you credit. They are not going to let you take advantage of the system. That's just the way it works. So quit trying to think about how you can game the system, because that's inappropriate. All right? So when you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve you for the 6 years of the sabbatical cycle. And in the seventh, at the beginning of that seventh, he shall go free for nothing, meaning whatever his debt is zeroed out. Now, verse 3, if he comes in single he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. However, if his master gives him a wife, now, in this case, master is actually acting in the place of a father. And so if his master provides him with a wife, and she bears him sons and daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out alone. Now, there is the likelihood, although it's not altogether clear, that in this example, the woman is actually a non-Israeli. Because we'll find out later that non-Israelis remained in servitude through the sabbatical year because they weren't Israelis. And so it's possible that this woman may in fact be a non-Israeli who's indebted to the same guy, but they fell in love because they were working together, and so the master lets them get married. Okay, so back to the text. Verse 5, here's the reason we're getting to it. If that slave plainly says, well, I love my master, my wife, my children, I'm not going to go out free. So I am not going to take my sabbatical release. Then his master shall bring him to God, which means to the tabernacle to begin with. He shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, which is just a fancy way of saying he pierces his ear, puts an earring in it, and he shall be his slave forever. Now, this is a voluntary slave. It is a permanent employee, if you will. It is, I think, what most of the New Testament writers have in mind in the New Testament when they say bond servant. I am a bond servant of Jesus Christ. I am a slave by choice. I love him. I don't want to leave him. I want to be marked as a man that is here, not because I owe money, but because I owe allegiance. And so it's a very interesting cultural illustration, because in most cultures they have something like this. Sometimes they're referred to as freedmen, where they got their indebtedness wiped out, but they continued serving the same person because they just liked working for them. They felt like they were part of his family. And so the freedmen were often looked at as a very special person in society, a very high status. We actually have examples of freedmen that get jobs in government because of such a high place in society. Now, the next part is where it gets rather tricky, and we're starting to run out of time, so I don't know how far we'll get through this. Because we're talking about money, the next thing we talk about is money that is exchanged because of betrothals, that is, engagements in our terminology, wedding arrangements, engagement arrangements. These were very big deals in this society. Remember, I've talked about this as like an alliance between families. Remember that Jacob did 7 years of work for his dowry in order to marry Rachel. Rachel. And so, no, I got that wrong, didn't I? No, it's Rachel. Okay, so anyway, a lot of money exchanges hands, and so because money's involved, it has to be in the rules. So verse number 7, when a man sells his daughter, and it's not as a slave, that's misunderstanding here. When a man gives his daughter for money, is basically what it's saying here. Meaning he's accepted betrothal money. He's not selling her as a slave. Don't get that idea. She shall not go out as the male slaves do. Well, duh, that's because she's not a slave. So when the seventh year rolls around, that doesn't zero out the betrothal. Okay? That's the rule. But verse number 8, if she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, meaning he's actually paid the dowry money for her to get married to him, but then he changes his mind that he's not going to marry her, then he shall let her be redeemed. So he can't treat her as if she is a slave, because she's not. Goes on very specifically, he shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, because she is not a slave. She never was a slave. She was someone he'd intended to marry, but then changed his mind. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. He is a breaker of an engagement, of a betrothal. He has violated the dowry agreement, which is why he won't get his money back. If he designated her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. So this is where we can start seeing very clearly, we're not talking about slavery. We're talking about betrothals. And therefore, the rules regarding money and indebtedness and slavery don't apply here with betrothals. And so that's why we have to spend some time on it. Well, we're out of time today, so mark your spot right there. And next time we get together, we'll get back into the Word.